Welcome to the September edition of BBRO Bcast. I'm Francesca Broom, your host and knowledge exchange manager for BBRO. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not overly keen on the creepy crawlies. But you can't help but wonder at the plethora of insects in our soil and admire those that endeavour to study and understand their life cycles. So this month, I meet up with independent agronomist Martin Cox to discuss a pest that impacts many crops, including sugar beet, and that's the mini but mighty wireworm.
So it's a glorious sunny day, heading towards the end of August, and we're ready for the September beetcast. And unusually, I'm not in a field of sugar beet this time. We're actually by a great big field of maize, in the middle of some potato growing country as well. And I am joined by Martin Cox, who is quite well known as an independent agronomist, but also an agricultural photographer. But he has a little bit of a sideline, and it's that I'm actually asking about today, because he is probably one of the most knowledgeable people when it comes to wireworm. And so today we're looking at the field that helped prompt his interest. So Martin, do you want to just tell us a little bit about why wireworm pest? What has actually got you looking at this in a little bit more detail?
They've been a problem in potatoes and a lot of crops for a long time. They were actually seen as a threat to national security during World War II, and a lot of research was done then. And it follows a lot of the history of crop protection in the UK and elsewhere, is that once you have a good solution to a problem, you stop researching the problem. Varicellas, anybody? Neonicotinoids? And so what we found was the neonicotinoid in sugar beet may have also played quite an important role in the wireworm problem as well, but because we also had a reasonably effective control in something called MOCAP, ethoprophos, organophosphate, growers tended to apply it prophylactically, and it had an effect on PCN and FLN as well. And if you had any wireworms there, it would reduce the damage quite significantly. It reduced the severity and the incidence. But that got withdrawn around about 2020. And at that time, growers probably, we didn't realise just how much it was keeping a lid on the problem.
And I think from conversations with you, it's not, yes, potatoes is where we hear the worst of the problem of wireworm, but this is a pest that affects numerous crops.
Yeah, we were getting a lot of problems in lettuces, because when lettuce growers transplant lettuces, they will take them out, and we were seeing damage for 3 or 4 days of planting, and they just go flop. They take them out completely. But, they take a lot of crops out. Cereals, I've seen cereals taken out in Kent this year. We assessed 2.3 million a hectare, threshold's about 750,000. Threshold for potatoes is probably down nearer 10 to 20,000. I've not seen a threshold for sugar beet, but they can really attack sugar beet. And if we lose Tetflutherin, and if growers think that they want to stop using Tetflutherin because they just don't like insecticides, they may find that it'd be very easy to count the plants, and you might find two. I mean, I remember before we had the neonics, we were using products like Marshall, Calvisulfan, I think that was, Yaltox, and the neonicotinoids came out, and they weren't phenomenally good on them. They don't actually kill larvae to the extent that Calvisulfan did, because we would look at sugar beet as they were coming up, and we'd see dead wireworms on the surface. It's lure and kill, really, because the pest would be drawn to the plant, and it would bang, and it would kill it.
Yeah.
And we also had HCH in the rotation, in oilseed rape and crops like that, and we had Aldrin up until the 1990s. So we'd had some pretty effective control, and other cultural factors were involved. Agriculture has changed immensely in that period, and cultivations have changed, rotations have changed, methods of doing things generally have changed, the insecticides we've got available to us have changed. And I look at sugar beet and I think, well, what happened in sugar beet that could have affected wireworms? Once you understand the activity of the pest, and I mean you understand the species involved, their life cycle, when they're active, what they're doing when they're active, what the cycles are, and you can understand any change in agriculture and its impacts. And we've had to do that to understand where we can change anything.
I think historically, wireworm is thought to be a pest that grows population within grassland.
Yeah.
But obviously, with the amount of wheat, I'm assuming it has the same impact.
Wheat can do, yeah. It's probably not going to build up the level of population, but I mean, when we look back at it, they'd say you needed about 10 years of grass to get a good population going, and by that, God only knows how many they mean. I mean, we measured 2.3 million a hectare in 2 years of ryegrass seed crop, 2 years wheat. They will lay eggs in wheat quite happily. And this very field here, I was looking at the crop. It had potatoes in it. We had wheat following that, spring barley following that, and beetroot following that, and then wheat after that. And I would say that probably none of the larvae that were in those potatoes would still be here. If we talk about July time, the larvae will pupate. Pupation doesn't take long, and it occurs in the soil. And then the adults will emerge from that pupae. They will stay pupa, rather. They'll stay below the soil surface, unless they're disturbed. And they will often stay within that period, within that zone, for the whole of the winter. And they will emerge in the spring, very much late March, early April. We start in late March. We've done a phenomenal amount of adult monitoring in the fens, and we've got people work with us up in from Scotland right down Cornwall.
So on a field of this size,
yeah.
How many traps will you put out?
Well, I put 14 in here, but to identify population density, it's phenomenally difficult. I've got a trial in Norfolk this year where we've got 360 square metres of trial. Potatoes, and we put bait traps in. I put 10 bait traps in that, and one of them didn't catch any. One caught 13. The average was 6 per trap. The average was 60 times the threshold that's been established. Old grassland is a big factor. What grassland does is it gives them everything they want. So if we look at the life cycle and we say, what's going to most closely resemble grassland? They are a pest that, for a start, we don't think they fly far. They're not strong flyers. They're not migratory. And we're looking at the main agriotes, because a lot of the other click beetles fly.
Yeah.
But the agriotes are not, the general opinion in the UK is they tend to walk. I know Bob Vernon in Canada has caught them in flight, lineatus particularly, but I've seen thousands and thousands of adult click beetles. I've never seen one fly. I've had them in 2022, They say above 25 degrees, they want to fly away or something. You know, we've been collecting them in 35 degrees and they still wouldn't fly. And literally you can put them up the end and they'll just drop on the ground.
Yeah.
They're called click beetles, interestingly, because if you put them on their back, they've got a ratchet, they've got a spring-like device in the body, and they'll literally turn themselves back over again. They click, and you've got them in your palm of your hand and you feel them go flick like that and they'll jump. And they're quite amazing.
When you're putting your pheromone traps out, you're actually having to buy separate pheromones to actually pick up a different species of wireworm, aren't you? So
How
do you define, before you put your trap in, what species you're looking for?
The pheromones are targeted at the male adults. And we've got pheromones for Agriotis, Sputaea, Obscurus and Lineatus. There are other Agriotis pheromones in the world. I think they got some from some other genera, etc., in America, but we could get them for sordidus, we could get them for ustulatus, but we don't have those species in the UK. We have some sordidus, but not in any number. We don't appear to. And the general opinion on the continent is they are roughly at the latitude of Dover. They don't really go for much further north. And we have got change in the UK. So what we do is we'll use pheromone to detect adult activity. So it'll tell us what species are about and also when they're active. And the number of them is a little bit of a confusing factor, but if you've got a lot of them, and to put it in perspective, you could be catching 1,000 a week of one species. And this is one of those things. When you have fields that don't fit the model, and believe you me, there are a lot of models for wireworms.
So but actually, you, from the work you've been doing, you are actually going to be releasing a review of all the work that's out there, aren't you?
We did a review at CUPGRA and it basically needs updating. What we're actually really doing at the moment is creating guidance. I mentioned this field in particular. We pheromone trap this field and we know we catch Lineatus obscurus sputaea. And we've pheromone trapped it. We pheromone trap on the farm and it indicates to me, are they relatively early, relatively a bit later in the season. It appears the adult's activity is about 10 degrees. They start to get active. And we definitely had much more early activity this year than we did in 2024. Much different. They don't really like cold, wet weather. They're insects, for God's sake. But, I mean, the interesting thing is the larvae. When we bait trap for larvae, we use a pre-chitted mixture, wheat and maize. Put that in, drop some in the middle. Away you go.
Just drop it in the pipe. And
drop
then...
it in the pipe. It makes a nice little tube of that, and away we go. How they were doing it was by having these plastic containers with holes in them and a little bit of mesh in the middle with it. And that's great. It kind of works. But if you're a little bit late getting back to it and it's been a bit warmer than you thought it was going to be, the mix can grow so much you can't get it out.
Right.
Because there's a little... The traps... Basically, what you need is a cap that goes over the top and doesn't have shoulders. So it expands to such an extent you can't... Now, we knew we were having that experience as agronomists, and we were largely bait trapping to see whether or not we used mocap in the spring. Fortunately, when I was doing my review, there's some work done in Germany, I believe, on a project called Simagrio. It's still running. They try to predict larval activity in soil based on temperature. And what it told us was the temperature threshold for activity in feeding was about 8 degrees. Right. And that kind of fitted with other stuff. If you look at where the core of the work has been done in Europe, the French are doing a massive amount. They've got €6.25 million grant at the moment to work on whiteworms, because it is just a bit of a pest in France. To give you an example, the onion growers used Teflutherin as a seed treatment.
Yeah.
And they lost it about 3 years ago. For a year, all hell let loose.
That is exactly what's happening with neonics.
Yeah,
we were working towards solving the issue.
Bang.
Neonics did the job for us, but look where we are now.
And I think we do need to keep plodding on. And a lot of the work we do is not particularly targeted at potato. It's targeted at a pest of a rotation. So when we look at pests, we say, are they like a topical pest? Is it like a leaf miner in sugar beet? Is it like a beet moth? They just arrive, they hammer you, they go away. They don't attack the wheat, they don't attack the onions, they don't attack the carrots. But wireworm can just be there chewing away at whatever's in the ground. And they will be developing. And because that their larval length is 4 years, the egg laying is going to be around about late April based on work that's been done in the world. And the Europeans are doing a lot of work. I mean, they're a pest from the Nordics down to Spain. They're into Greece. They're a pest from Russia to Canada. And lo and behold, Agriotis obscurus, we've got a lot of in this field, is a pest in all those places.
And yet, you've said we actually identified this pest and started work pre-Second World War, and here we are, and I know you've said that in this very field, you found species that no one had actually documented as being in the UK.
What we have to remember is that agriculture hadn't. So I look at the National Biodiversity Network, which I do for anything, leaf arbors, plant arbors, anything like that, and see what records are out there. I mean, for instance, I was looking at Empoasca decipiens, which is leaf hopper, and I think there's a sixfold increase in their records since 1970. And I think for one of the other leaf hoppers, there's about a 12-fold increase. So, you know, we know from 1970 to 2020-ish, there's been a massive increase in leaf hopper species, in leaf hopper catches. Doesn't necessarily mean the pest has increased. It means there's more records, but we would assume that it's been low from 1890 to 1970, and it certainly coincides. You know, there may be a factor. And the thing is, with click beetles, there's a lot of click beetles. So,
but you've said there are over 70 different species, and not all of them will have impact. Right. So, if a grower, if they find that they've got wireworm, how do they get that identification of the species?
We've produced all that information.
And where is that available?
Just Google it mainly. Google me and wireworms and you'll find it. A lot of presentations I've given. But what we're doing at the moment is I went to an EAPR meeting in Arras in September 23, which is great. I remember it vividly. I caught COVID on the way back and I was ill for quite a while. So I went to EAPR Arras. We had a lovely meet, and it was decided at the meeting there was such an interest in wireworms that we should actually get together and have a research network. We've launched the European Wireworm Research Network, which we launched in spring 24. So we've got this group now, and what we want to create is pan-European information. But just before I went, I bait trapped this field, because what we'd done is in the fourth crop, so winter wheat, spring barley, beetroot, wheat. In the spring of 2023, I was walking this field with the farmer, whose base is qualified, and I saw some wheat going off, and I said, that's going off for some reason or other. So I dug it up, and I found Agrotis wireworm. And I said, oh, that's a bit of a problem because it's a potato grower. So we found several. And I said, ah, when's it coming potatoes? And he said, oh, year after next. And that's this year. It's not potatoes, is it? So come the autumn, I'd put my traps out, went to a RAS, got COVID, came back, left the traps a bit longer, came and took them out. So if we bear in mind that the established threshold we would have had was one wireworm in 10 traps. We had 14 traps, one and a half wireworms. Which end, it doesn't matter, right? So they established that one wireworm in 10 traps was a threshold, and I would say that's broadly about right. That it's not an absolute detection, it's not a numerical. You can't identify the level of population from bait traps because we know at certain times of the year, even in the autumn, they will not all be active. They only feed for a certain amount of the time. If they're pupating, they won't be feeding. So we know it's a fallible process. So 32 Adrastis, I believe it was.
Right.
19 Hemicrepidus. Interestingly, that's the majority of them. Neither of those were mentioned in any of the literature other than one sentence, I think, that they didn't know much about them. So the Adrastis palans, which is not a predator, not a plant feeder, was the dominant species.
Okay.
Next to that, we had Hemicrepidus niger, or Hirtus niger, which you can't identify them to species morphologically. Bearing in mind they're supposed to be synonymous anyway here. But we had a lot of those, and they are very predatory. I've got a video of one of those attacking an Athos. I've got a picture of an Agriotis wyom eating another one. So we know they're predatory, okay?
Yep.
We have, beyond any reasonable doubt, we had 13 Agriotis, which is 13 times the threshold.
Yeah.
And we had 4 Melanotus, which is where my friend Houdini is, and he's a Melanotus. They are supposed to live
I will, for the benefit of the listeners, Houdini is sort of a pet one that you've been looking after?
Yeah, I've been keeping him. They're quite interesting. And he keeps escaping, but he has his container and he gets out of it. So what we had in here was we had an enormous number of wireworms.
So it's really important for growers to understand
what they've got,
what species they've got,
yeah,
and actually take, whether it be rotation or a treatment where they can, yeah. They've got to manage it according to each field, haven't they?
But if you do it well and you know what you're doing, and we've taught a lot of people how to do it, we're getting reliable indicators that they're there. The other thing, what we tend to do now, we have a pretty well-documented risk assessment. That risk assessment, what I did is there's lots of models on the continent. So I ranked the top 5 dominant risk factors. Give them like podium finishes. So the one with the lowest number was the highest risk. So it was first.
Yeah.
So if it's 5 surveys and it scored 5, it was top in all of them. So you can kind of get a pecking order. And I went through this with Bruno the other week and we were chatting about it. And I said, what were your dominant ones? And we said, soil type, cropping, management of intercrops is phenomenally important, and the area around the field. So have you got big areas of grass? On these slightly stronger peats, they've got a bit of body in them, a bit of clay, a bit of silt in them, we find some quite phenomenal populations. And I've surveyed grass margins just by digging a cubic foot of soil up and then sifting it and seeing what's in there, and I'm developing better ways of getting them out.
It's almost like you started to scratch the surface, and what you've opened is this
can of worms,
Pandora's box. Can you see an end to it? I mean, is there other beneficials that are having an impact?
Yeah, there are some. Interestingly, the stilettofly larvae, they are considered to be predators. The predation thing is really interesting. We did a study in Shropshire, and it was on an organic farm. We were looking at management of stubbles. And we had naturally regenerated stubbles. We had naturally regenerated stubble, buckwheat, mustard bifume, which is another replicate. And then we had what we wanted to have was bare soil. And to achieve that, they used a gas burner because it was an organic farm. But we would have normally round up to patch it, but they couldn't.
Yeah.
because what we feel is very, very important. And this was a piece of work to try and monitor the change of the juveniles, which are tiny. They're 1.5 mil when they hatch, and they will get to probably about 3 mil in the autumn. And they have probably 3 instars in the autumn. They have a lot more. A lot of people will talk about 1, 2, 3, 4 instars. They have probably 14 instars. They have a long life. So relatively, they can have a lot of years. I think 10 years they can live for. Or some only have a 30-day.
Right. You know,
there's, in terms of wireworm species in the world, probably 8,000, 10,000 species of latrids in the world. So, but what we know is that...
I'm just rather thankful. We've only got 73 of them here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they've got 250 in France. So, you know, so and a lot of them we have not. What we know is that they will invade from grass margins. They will invade from meadows. They'll invade from just in the fen. A ditch is enough. They'll just come out of there. They love a bit of moisture. It just gives them. The eggs need humidity to hatch, moisture to hatch. And ideally, you would not disturb it May, June. We don't tend to, but any disturbance May, June, any really powerful insecticide around the plant most likely would end their little life. We then get to the stage where we get to the larvae need actively growing plants apparently to feed and avoid starvation. So we get to the harvest of a cereal crop, and lo and behold, in the 1970s, before we had glyphosate, they all hell would let loose. Everything would be cultivated 2 or 3 times to get rid of cooch and volunteers and God only knows what else. When we got Roundup, that kind of was diminished, and it was called recreational cultivation. So the farmers said, oh, old dad caught on that Vercingetorix bugger. And it went on like that. And then in the 1990s, we lost Aldrin. And then around about the end of that decade, we would have lost gamma-HCH. Gamma-HCH would have been used in the early autumn on rape crops and things like that. And we, at some point, when we got the neonicotinoids, we lost these really effective insecticides for the granular insecticides, carbamates, for sugar beet, for carrots, for onions, for what have you. And they would also have killed wireworms. We don't have those now. We do have pyrethroids, but they are less likely to kill them. They're more likely to repel or make them. They could make them starve, but when we actually look at the dynamics of it, those treatments tend to be used after root crops. They don't lay eggs in root crops quite as much. They like to lay eggs in cereals. They like to lay eggs in soil that is covered with vegetation. They need to have something. There's a growing good food source. So cereals fit the bill. Grass fits the bill. The reason grass is so much better is because there isn't this gap. It's constantly growing. There's no disturbance. I mean, what we're finding is if you've got 2/3 of your rotation is cereals, if you are allowing stubbles to naturally regenerate. So does a cover crop make it worse? And I'll say worse than what? And people say, well, worse than if we just leave a stubble. And from what we know, with absolutely no doubt whatsoever, is that naturally regenerating stubble that just comes back up is very, very, very suitable for wireworms. Where they help, they do not lay eggs in cover crops because they lay their eggs in mandune. We know that. For egg laying, they prefer grasses. I mean, the function that a cover crop will have in the UK is to provide food for the larvae that have hatched that year, and they're small and they need to feed. And in that situation, if you avoid cereals, they're less likely to survive. The advice from Austria regarding cover crops is if you cultivate well a time or two before your cover crop and just leave it bare of plants for a week or two, that should reduce the level of survival of the juveniles for that year, and every year you do that risk assessment. So basically, if you've put a cover crop in every year after a stubble, so in a cereal crop, it's prime egg-laying territory, and if you're worried about wireworms, you would avoid a cereal in that cover crop. What I would say is that cover crops, they're the rules for cover crops. If you've got sugar beet, certainly, if you've got any situation in May, June, i.e. cereals, or basically some form of stewardship option, and the longer it's in, the better it is for wireworms. So you have your egg-laying situation, and then you have your autumn food. And if you do both of those well enough for the wireworm, so in other words, you've either got green cover through summer, through autumn, unbroken, or you've got a cereal, and you go straight in with the cover crop, which got a lot of cereal or cereal volunteers in it, you would be expected to facilitate 1 year survival, and they would become damaging size in 2 to 3 years' time. So whatever you do with a cover crop, a head of sugar beet is vastly unlikely to reduce or increase the risk to sugar beet. What we're seeing in cereals in Kent is that they do 2-year ryegrass seed crops, then a wheat. That wheat survives generally. The wheat after doesn't, right, because they've grown
just
big
just
enough.
So many, yeah.
Yeah, so now they're bigger.
Yeah.
It's like a conveyor belt. They get bigger every year. And basically, once you've got to year threes and four, you've got a lot of big damage in larvae.
Once you've done your final update of the review, it'd be great, yeah, if we could perhaps have that on the BBO website, and then growers can click on there and have a look, and hopefully I'll give them some support. And I think you're open to the contact as well, aren't you?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so growers got a particular problem, then please do make contact. Well, Martin, I think we could certainly stand here all day, because there is just so much going on. And I think, obviously, you're a font of knowledge on not just wireworm, I think an awful lot within agriculture. I think on behalf of probably the whole industry, just say thank you for your tenacity to pick up such a project and, you know, be investigating it on our behalf. So thank you very much, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to contact Martin or hear more of his research, you'll find him online at Martin Cox Wireworms or Blackthorn Arable Limited. We will also be circulating a link to his review when it's finally published. It was certainly interesting to hear that not all wireworms are villains to the farming world, and perhaps we should remember that when we look closer at who's inhabiting our soil. Just leaves me to wish you a safe harvest. Please keep an eye on those overhead pylons. Thank you for listening.